Welcome to Cowside Conversations, a monthly podcast brought to you by the Center for Dairy Excellence. We've heard time and time again that dairy farmers learn the most from other dairy farmers. So in this podcast, we are going to share real-time farmer insights, tricks of the trade, and inspiring stories from dairies across Pennsylvania. I'm Jane Seabright, director at the Center. Here's this month's episode. Thanks for joining this episode. With the spring planting season already ramping up, most farmers are starting to turn their thoughts to how they can get the best forages possible for their herd in the coming year. With what you feed your cows directly correlated to what their milk production and components look like, I asked Duane Stoltzfus, a partner at Penwin Farms in Somerset County, to share a little bit about what they are doing to manage their nutrition program on the farm. I also asked him to share a little bit about their digester and how they are working to bring in the next generation. Thanks for joining me today, Duane.
Hello.
So can you get started by telling me a little bit about your dairy, who is involved, and your size and scale?
Okay. So Penwood Farms is an LLC owned and operated by four brothers, oldest brother Don, Glenn, Dwight, and then myself, Duane. Currently milk just a little bit over 600 cows and crop about 2,000 acres.
So tell us a little bit about your history of your farm and how you ended up in Berlin, Pennsylvania.
Well, okay, the history of the farm, Penwood Farms, was actually started in 1962 by my mother and father, Harvey and Mary Jane Stoltzfus. Started milking 18 cows, small 50-acre farm that they rented. Yeah, that grew over the years in Morgantown, PA, down in southeast PA. By the mid-1900s, say 92, 95 range, the four of us boys were all wanted to work together. And expansion at that point in the Morgantown area was kind of unrealistic, so we made the decision to relocate. That was probably about a 10-year process. Eventually ended up relocating to Somerset County, Berlin. Moved up here, we built the farm, built the barn to milk about 400 couple cows, had about 400 acres of cropland at that point, kind of grown since then.
So how has the operation evolved since you came to Somerset County as far as size and scale?
Well, I mean, yeah, really since then we're currently milking a little over 600 cows. So we have grown cow number-wise, and also we've expanded the cropping operation. Well, we're cropping about 2,000 acres at this point. It has grown and evolved since then. We do most of our own cropping, do a lot of custom work, some of the manure hauling.
So tell us a little bit about the different roles and responsibility on the farm and how the management structure is divided up between the partners involved.
Okay, so yeah, there's four of us here involved, well, as managers, I guess you might say. Don kind of takes care of the equipment part of it, keeps the tractors all running. Glenn is the crop man or the agronomist on the property, I guess you might say. White takes care, he's the herd manager, herdsman, and takes care of the, you know, herd health and that kind of end of it. And then I am kind of the nutritional expert, I guess, or I wouldn't say expert, but anyway, I handle the nutritional end of it, you know, as to what the cows get fed and managing all that forage inventory and that kind of thing. And also I take care of the digester.
What are some of the core goals of your operation and how are you working towards those goals as a team?
I'm going to kind of relay to our mission statement because that's the easiest and simplest answer. The mission of our farm is to conduct a dairy business that is a positive Christian influence on the community and everyone we deal with. Strive to be honest and fair in our dealings and profitable in our enterprises. also want to provide a quality standard of living for ourselves and all of our employees. And I guess the other answer to that would be, you know, we try and make as much milk as we can and do it as best as we can.
That's a good answer. So how do you think your feeding program plays a role into the profitability of your farm?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously a feeding program has a significant impact on a profitability because it's one of your largest expenses. It is your largest expense. We try and do the best we can with the feed that we have, go from there.
So can you tell me a little bit about the top five ways your dairy manages your feed costs?
It's an ongoing process. One of the things that I guess we had to learn when we relocated out here was bunk management, primary one. We obviously use trench piles feed, and they can be a significant drain on your profitability. Brink gets out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we spend a considerable amount of time trying to do a good job packing, covering the trenches correctly, also the feed out part.
Let's first talk about how you're packing and your feed out part. So you said you spend a considerable amount of time making sure that you're getting a good pack. What does that look like? How many tractors? What are you covering your trenches with? What are you trying to do to make sure you're getting that bunk packed as tight as possible?
Well, the number of tractors obviously depends on the rate of the feed coming in. And generally, because I'm the feed man, I'm the one in the trench. And so I end up being the one that has to be the good guy or the bad guy, one or the other. So if I'm not keeping up, then I make sure we add a tractor. If that means taking somebody off of a truck or a hauling rig, then that's what we do. Or some of the other things we do is cover our side walls with plastic. We use probably more plastic than most farms to try, I guess, for lack of a better term, encapsulate storage, keep moisture pollution out, and obviously an oxygen barrier. The oxygen barriers are a pain in the neck, trying to cover the trench in as well.
Yeah, and what's the oxygen? Is it? Are you using plastic and tires, or what's your oxygen barrier look like?
Oh, no, I'm talking about, plastic and tires on top. And I'm talking about, like, the underlayment or whatever, I'm not sure what the industry term is for. But it almost looks like saran wrap.
Mm-hmm.
Started using that probably about 5 years ago, and that made a big difference. That goes on top of the forage, and then you pull the plastic over top, and then tires.
And then you had said the plastic makes a big difference. Any idea how much feed you're saving in spoilage from the plastic oxygen barrier that you're adding, that you've been adding last 5 years? Like, have you cut down on feed spoilage, or what kinds of things has that been able to help you do?
Well, I guess I don't really have an exact number, but I can tell you, you know, we've gone from hauling truckloads of spoilage out to one or two. So, you know.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
And so, yeah, I can't really put a number on that. We do at this point have a chopper that has a yield monitor on it, and that's an ongoing process. You never really know. We don't weigh everything going in.
So you make sure you get it packed good and tight, and then on the feed out side, what are you doing to make sure you're feeding it out to try and make sure you're, you know, getting the most out of your forages?
Well, from the feed out side, I mean, we actually use a rake, not a rotary facer. It's not a mechanical facer, but it's all rake. So you're not digging any more loose than you need to. That has made a difference.
And then, how many bunks are you feeding out of? What are you trying to do to prevent other things? Are you trying to do to prevent forage spoilage?
Well, yeah, obviously we have to monitor generally we're feeding out of two bunks at a time, your corn, our corn silage bunk, and then our whatever the hay crop or small grain crop bunk is. Mm-hmm. We have in the past tried to feed out of three at a time. Generally, then you can't keep up. So we've gotten away from that.
Are you adding anything to the forages to make sure that they keep when you're putting it in? What kind of inoculants or that kind of thing are you using?
We do use a lactobacillus inoculant.
And then other areas, you know, I had asked about like five things you're doing to manage. You talked about forage costs as far as looking at putting that forages in. Are you looking at a certain digestibility of the plant, or when you said you're on the bunk, making sure it gets back tight? Like, how are you making decisions in the field to make sure that's at its ultimate digestibility and that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, certainly from a corn silage standpoint, which is our primary forage, I guess you might say, we do yield or field checks as the crop's getting ready. Basically, we're cutting stalks out of fields that we're going to harvest and seeing where the moisture's at, when the optimal time to start would be.
Mm-hmm. And then once it's in the bunk, what are some of the things you're doing to manage your profitability and your feed costs on the farm, in the feeding side of the business?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, once it's in the bunk, you're going to feed it. So.
Yeah.
And then you have to go from there. But one of the other things is we use a flat storage commodity bay, commodity shed, I guess you might say, for our grain ingredients. We are aggressive about keeping them clean and scraped up. Flat storage commodity sheds obviously have their advantages for ease of use, but they can be a significant shrink if they're not managed correctly. And so we keep a shovel and a scraper down there and we use it. Helps a lot.
Yeah. And then when you're feeding, tell us a little bit about the feed watch system you're using to manage inventories and how you're using that to manage feed costs.
Yeah, certainly that has helped. It gives us an exact or an accurate number of what we're feeding out, what goes into the cows, what gets delivered to the cows. And so we kind of go from there. From another standpoint, it has also given me a more accurate, from our ingredient or commodity shed grain ingredients that we're purchasing, what we're actually using per day. So I don't, for lack of a better term, over-inventoried. So that has helped.
And then what are some other ways you're mitigating your feed costs and trying to manage your feeding inventories the best way possible?
Well, one of the other things we do, and we kind of made this decision really a long time ago, when I say long, 15 years, we grow as much as possible of what we're going to feed to minimize what we have to buy in on a truck.
So what's that look like?
We have three vertical silos here that we use, and if necessary, ag bags for high moisture corn storage, which is obviously a source of energy for the diet. We drastically limit our purchase of energy.
And then are you also raising soybeans for meal, or are you buying your soybeans? What's that look like?
Essentially, the protein ends up being a purchased ingredient. We do grow beans, typically a couple hundred acres of beans in our cropping program, but they are all, historically, have all been marketed basically by bean meal.
And then what are some other ways when you're feeding it, how many groups are you feeding a day? What's that look like?
Currently, our diet is a two-group diet. We do milk some Jerseys. There are about 120 of the 600 some cows are Jerseys. They're commingled. We don't feed them any different than anybody else.
On the Jerseys, what How are they different? Are they helping with your components, or what is your goals with the jerseys?
Well, the jerseys came about shortly before we moved to Somerset, and they have grown. They multiply, and certainly they help our component part. To be quite honest with you, I question sometimes why they are still here. They are an aggressive cow, and they do well, but at the end of the day, they don't quite get as many pounds of solids out the door. That's the long of the short.
So how have you been making your decisions related to the forages that you're growing, and what is the mix of the forages you're using?
Well, our forage program for what we're putting into bunks has kind of evolved here in the last probably 3 to 5 years. We have gone to a more small grain-based cover crop type of program, relying less and less on an alfalfa and haylage, or a grass and alfalfa haylage mix.
And then what small grains are you guys planting?
Mostly it's either rye or triticale as a cover crop after the corn silage is taken off, and then we harvest that in the spring before we replant corn.
And then you're double cropping everything?
Well, I wouldn't say everything, but yeah. Well, on that ground, we are, yes.
How are you selecting? Are you using any BMR corn silage, or is it all conventional?
Yeah. I would say we run probably about a 50-50 BMR to conventional corn. When I say conventional, I'm talking about conventional corn silage varieties, not like a grain. And generally, we do have some dual purpose. We grow about 1,100 acres of corn, 1,000 to 1,100 acres of corn. Certainly, we do not need near all of that for our corn silage needs. So it becomes a game where you try and plant as much corn silage varieties as you're going to need. The rest of it is either a dual purpose or a grain crop corn variety.
So the strategies that you have in place to ensure that you're getting the maximum nutrition out of your forages, what is that strategy? What do the strategies look like on the planting and the seed selection side? Like what kind of seeds? What are you looking for in the planting your seed selection?
Glenn's more the agronomist than I am. Obviously, on a corn silage side of it, we try to maximize the digestibility and the starch level at the same time. It's a juggling act. On the hay crop side of it, that's generally a harvest timing issue as much as anything as far as your quality. So,
So what are your goals for the harvest period? Like, I know that your weather out in Somerset can be a little bit fickle, right? It can get really cold and nasty early. And do you ever run into issues where you worry about early frost? What does the harvest season look like for you guys?
Well, obviously we do deal with some fickle weather. I'm looking out the window right now and it's actually snowing. But anyway, generally we figure about probably a 2 week shorter growing season than most of the rest of the state. And obviously there's probably portions of the state that would have similar growing season to ours, but versus where we moved from in Morgantown, kind of figure about a 2 week shorter growing season. When we were down in Morgantown, if it got to the middle of October and you got your cover crop planted, that was fine. Really, realistically, here in Somerset, you need to have it in the ground by the 1st of October if you want to have a potential for a crop to harvest in the spring.
And so that makes managing through the harvest season a little bit challenging. You got to make sure you're taking advantage of every opportunity. When you're getting that those forages in, what kind of testing and monitoring are you doing to better manage the crop in the field and during the harvest period?
Well, certainly we monitor the kernel processing on the harvester. But as far as testing, you know, when we decide to start chopping basically chop till we're done. So.
And then how are you managing the feed when it's in the bunk? What kind of testing are you doing on the ration itself and the bunk samples?
Well, certainly I work with a nutritionist, and probably at least monthly we are pulling samples and sending them for analysis, making any adjustments that need to be made. The biggest one is obviously the moisture thing, and dry down and monitor the moisture as best I can. One of my bosses when I worked for Cargill was a nutritionist, and somebody said, well, how often should you check your moisture? And he said, every time it changes. What I try to do.
What ratio of forages versus grains are you feeding in the milking herd?
Well, we have typically run around 50-50 when we can feed a little, when we feed a little higher concentration of corn silage. You know, when I say that, I mean above 60% forage corn silage. Generally, you can drop your grain a little bit. You don't need as much either high moisture corn or other energy products. Right now, we're feeding a little more hay crop based diet. So it's that ratio of corn silage to haylage is probably closer to 50-50. Obviously, that takes a little more grain. You need to make up the energy. So, yeah, it's typically around 50-50 on a forage to concentrate ratio, plus or minus.
And does it change at all during their lactation stage?
Generally not. I mean, the later lactation cows will get a little more forage, and that is part of that two-group TMR. That is for that later lactation cows. And it's really not a whole lot different, but it is a little bit.
And then what's your top cow ration? What are you feeding for in pounds of milk?
Basically, creating a diet for the high cows, which includes some of the Jerseys, which are their top in their lactation as well, for about 55 pounds, 52 to 55 pounds of dry matter intake. Obviously, the cows that are milking more than that, well, Woodstat will make about 80 to 90 pounds. Obviously, the cows that are peaking out are eating way over that 55. Basically, that's what you kind of got to play that game. We're trying to shoot for 6 pounds of components out the door or better than that.
So you're shooting for 6 pounds of components out the door. So you're feeding that high group a pretty high-powered ration to keep up with that. And then your low group, you're feeding to balance out the higher cows. So on your dry cows, what does that ration look like?
It is a grass hay diet and corn silage, whatever bean meal you need to make up to get to the protein to where it needs to be.
And how important, how much are you working with the nutritionist on that feeding program?
On the dry cow program? We work very closely with the nutritionist on. And when I said that, grass hay and corn silage diet, that is the far off. We have a two-group dry cow program. The close-up program, we are acidifying with an Animate product, and yes, we work very closely with the nutritionists to try and monitor that and minimize fresh cow issues.
So how has the feed watch system you've been using changed your ability to manage your overall feeding program, and how are you and the nutritionist using that program together?
I mean, essentially, it gave us a really accurate number of what we wanted, and that's what we were looking for, of what the cows are actually eating. Obviously, the nutritionist and I can use that data to generate any, or income over feed costs, whatever numbers you want from there. But you have to start with that accurate number of what the cows are eating. That software program has certainly done that for us, and that's kind of what we were looking for.
How long have you been using the FeedWatch program?
Year and a half, maybe.
So you talked about it makes a really good difference in understanding what the cows are eating. How has it changed how you're managing your rations or shifted anything in your feeding program?
Well, in all reality, it hasn't changed it a whole lot. It just gives us more accurate data. I guess the long and the short is from that standpoint, prior to using that program, we weren't as far off as we thought maybe we might be. Essentially, that's the long and the short. We kind of had an idea of what we thought the cows were eating. I myself am one of the primary feeders here, and we have one other one, an employee that I trust very much, and I know he does a good job. It wasn't like we were straying.
Yeah, so there's a lot of confidence because you don't have a lot of people feeding the cows. How are you guys using the data that you're pulling off of FeedWatch, and how often are you looking at that data?
At the very least, at least once a month, I will send the nutritionist the data of what the cows ate, and more often than not is more than once a month, and then he can use, and well, obviously we have to plug in the milk out the door and components and all that.
Is he using the information he's getting from FeedWash to look at, are you guys using it to look at feed costs and think through how you could be shifting things
in the
diet itself?
Yeah, obviously we're either trying to cut some costs, you know, make the ration a little bit cheaper, or trying to figure out how to make them make a little bit more, one or the other. So, but yeah, we do obviously use that data, yeah, all the time.
Has the FeedWatch system, like, what's the return on investment then? Do you have any idea?
Well, I hesitate to use the FeedWatch. I think that's a commercial name. The product that I'm using, I guess, is a Digistar product, and it is a cloud-based product. Essentially, there was little or no. We did have to get a new scale head that is Bluetooth compatible. Basically, you run it with either a tablet or your cell phone or your smartphone. The downside to that, I guess you might say, is there is a annual subscription fee then that goes with it, and it's a couple hundred dollars. So, yeah, it's really not a big, I know historically some of them, PMR Watch or whatever programs that they had out there, you had to buy a whole new, yeah, you had to reinvent a computer, basically. And this is very cost effective.
And it's allowed you to help manage your feeding program a lot better and a lot more closely.
And they have different levels. The program that I'm using has different levels. You can subscribe and pay a little more, I guess, for even more information or more data, whatever. I'm not sure you'd have to.
So what are some of the key attributes that you're looking at in relation to digestibility and nutritional value of your forages? And what are some of your goals around those forages?
Obviously, you want your hay crop silage to be in at least that. I mean, now we run a mixed hay crop silage, alfalfa and grass. So realistically, if you hit 20, that's pretty good. Obviously, you'd like it higher in protein. Generally, that's not how it works. Corn silage end of it, you want to hit as much starch as you can before the digestibility drops off. So, yeah. And that's part of that waiting game when you really think you ought to be out chopping corn and maybe
it's not quite ready yet.
Yeah, if you give it another couple of days, that milk line will move a little further and you'll jump a couple points in starch, and you wait 3 days too long and all of a sudden your digestibility is, it's a juggling act. I mean,
let's talk a little bit about the digester. So how long have you guys had the digester?
The digester was installed in the fall of 2010, operational in 2011. Some days it's a lot of effort to keep it running. Some days it doesn't take as much.
So why did you guys decide to install the digester? What was the initial thinking around that?
I guess this was my brainchild. And I have a father-in-law that's an electrician. And he kept telling me and hounding me about it. You guys need to be doing this. And so we kind of explored it and looked into it. And in all reality, the digesters basically subsidy money. They're not viable. And when that money became available, we decided to install it.
How are you using the digester? Is it providing electricity for your farm? Like, are you using the bedding? What's that look like?
Yes, we do. It does provide enough electricity for the farm. We do market some electric. Yeah, we used the effluent gets separated for bedding. One of the biggest fits to the jet, to the digester, I would say, we try to use as much of the heat off of the engine as we can.
And where are you using the heat at?
We have a large machine shop here. It's heated solely by that. It also heats part of my house and at the parlor here, heating hot water, that kind of thing.
You said about the biggest benefit is the heat and then the bedding and the electricity. Are there other benefits that you've been seeing with the digester?
They say there is an odor reduction, and I don't know that there are any complaints. We didn't really ever get many. This is a rural area, but I will say the first year we started hauling manure after we had the digester up and running, one of the ladies in town stopped the truck. It was an employee of ours, and asking, he said, "What are you hauling?" I said, "Well, we're hauling manure." She said, "Well, it doesn't smell like it." And this was a lady that had not been told that it was going to be reduced in odor or anything. So I think it does have, I think that is a benefit. It depends on the person. If somebody thinks it stinks, they're going to think it stinks. Somebody thinks mm-hmm. it doesn't stink, well, then they're going to think
it. But it sounds like some people have actually noticed the difference, so that's good.
Well, it was kind of interesting that somebody actually made that observation, somebody that really hadn't been given that information before.
Yeah, that's really good. So how does that digester fit into your larger operation?
Some days it's a pain, and we're not set up to take food waste. When we built the thing, we made the decision we didn't want to deal with that extra effluent to have to land apply, and so we didn't set it up that way. I would say probably from a larger farm perspective, a larger operation perspective, we should have set it up to deal with that, because we probably have missed that opportunity as far as a cash income.
So you said this was actually originally your brainchild. Has it helped you accomplish what you had thought it would?
I would say it has, yeah. Certainly from an electricity and a utility standpoint, it has accomplished that goal. I guess I maybe was a little bit, I didn't realize it was going to take as much time.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I heard one somebody liken a digester to, it's almost like working with a cow. I mean, it's a living being, so it does take takes both mechanical time and attention to the inner workings and making sure the system, the biological system, is working well.
Well, certainly it is. I mean, it's the extension of the cow, the biological part of it. The biggest, I guess, beef or problem I have with it at this point is the thing is, I say 11, so it's knocking on 12, 13 years old. Biogas is a very, very, for lack of a better term, a bad gas. It is harsh on just about any environment you can put it in, so it's really hard on anything mechanical. Obviously, with a system like that, there's a lot of mechanics involved. You get to 10 years, and for lack of a better term, the wheels fall off of everything. Then you have the maintenance expense.
So how much time do you think each day you're spending on working on the digester?
I wouldn't say it's quite half of my time, but it's probably not as far from it as I'd like. How's that for an answer?
No, that's a good answer. So it's about 50% of your time. And then obviously it's probably a lot to balance when you're busy in the planning or the harvesting season and you're being pulled elsewhere. It probably is definitely a drain, making sure that's keeping running too.
Correct. Because, I mean, certainly I'm involved in a lot of the other operations around here. Some of that stuff with a digester, you can't really schedule.
So another area I wanted to talk to you a little bit about was transition. I know you started working with Charlie Gardner, who's one of our consultants, a little bit, and you guys have begun thinking about transition. So can you talk a little bit about what that is looking like and who you're involving in that conversation?
I think a lot of it has been accomplished. I guess we have a plan in place or a process in place. Initially, the farm here was a general partnership between the four brothers. Initially, my father was involved as well, but that has evolved into an LLC, which makes it a lot more manageable from a transition standpoint. But to be perfectly honest with you, we started this whole process probably close to 10 years ago, meeting with advisors, whatnot. And, it takes a while. There is finally a plan in place.
So you have this transition plan in place, and you have the four brothers who are partners. But what's that next generation look like for you, and what are some of the things that you did with that plan to make sure you made room for them?
Well, certainly moving to an LLC makes it more feasible for them to enter, or more accessible for them to enter, opposed to trying to buy into a general partnership or whatever. We do have some next generations that are interested. We'll say one of the things that was advised to us really early on in our conversations was anybody that is interested in coming back needs to go do something else for a couple of years. That's one of our policies, is if you want to come back, go do something else for a couple of years.
Did you have anyone go do something else for a couple of years and then decide not to come back?
And not yet. Well, we had next generations that had left with really no intention of coming back. And it really wasn't their cup of tea anyway. And that's fine.
Good. So why do you think that talking about a plan and having a plan in place? So you had said that your dad was a partner, and you know, you guys moved from Eastern Pennsylvania to Berlin, and you guys formed a partnership. So you basically have been the next generation in a previous transition. So now you're looking at this next generation, and why do you think it's important that you guys think through your plan and have it written down?
For lack of a better term, whenever the four of us formed a partnership with my dad initially, it was a little smaller scale. Obviously, it was big scale in our minds at that point. But now things are, with all the liabilities and everything, everything's a lot more complicated. Yeah, you need to have a plan in place.
When do you think a family, so your family, your next generation, most of them are still in their 20s, right?
Yeah, my kids are all still in their 20s, yes. Or before that, or younger than that, so.
And then other next generation, like your brother's kids, are they early 30s?
Correct.
So when do you think that a farm should start thinking about transition?
About 10 years before you think it's necessary.
That's a good answer, about 10 years before you think it's necessary. And why do you think that they should think about it 10 years before you think it's needed?
Because it's not something that's going to happen overnight, or it's not something that's going to happen around the kitchen table one evening with a napkin for notes. It's a lot more complicated than that. And, I mean, part of what we had to deal with with our operation is third generation, I guess you might say, is there's a very wide spread in age. Some of them are thinking about coming back and ready to do that. Some of them are in ninth grade in high school, and that's a wide range. So you can't ask somebody in ninth grade in high school to make that decision. So you need to come up with a plan where it's possible for anybody and everybody, if that's what they want to do.
That's a really good point, that, you know, you really got to have a plan for those, because you're not going to all be the same age or doing it at all at the same time. And you're really preparing them so they know what the opportunities are for them. So how important do you think an outside consultant is to transition?
Oh, I would say, I mean, at least for us, and you mentioned Charlie, and there was others involved, it's absolutely essential. Maybe some dairy farmers are smarter than we are, but you can't dream up all this stuff on your own.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It takes someone out to help you navigate it through it. Thank you so much for joining me today, Duane. I thought your perspective on your feeding program, your digester, and your goals for transition were really insightful. Hopefully those listening can take some of your ideas and apply them to their own dairy. Thanks also to everyone listening today. As always, this podcast is brought to you by the Center for Dairy Excellence to share farmer insight, tricks of the trade, and inspiring stories from dairies across the state. For more episodes, subscribe to the series on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Enjoy the beautiful early spring weather we are having.